mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
From some of these numbers that seem to be defying gravity this year as it relates to things like tariffs and a fairly stable economy or even a resilient economy that should maybe be driving prices higher.
Yeah, on the inflation front, this is definitely a number I would not take at the headline value. Folks were pretty quick to point out that this is a pretty major surprise to the downside. Expectations were for 3 to 3.1% from all the main major aggregators. To come in and at, you know, close to 0.5% under is a pretty big miss.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Happy holidays. It is the 22nd of December. This will be our last podcast of the year. Got some really good content today. We're going to do a real quick market update. We did get some really important Bureau of Labor Statistics data last week on unemployment and inflation. And then we're going to go right into our 2026 preview. So just previewing all the things that we should be thinking about as we go into next year, especially things in the economy or in the world or in our industry that could affect volume, interest rates, and other kind of areas of the mortgage business. Before we get there, though, a little bit of data. The OBMMI is at 6.17 today, and the 10-year is at 4.17. So the spread is exactly 2% right now. That's about as small as it's been over the past 4 or 5 years. So good news there. Potentially seeing that continue going into 2026, tightening of that spread. So let's go ahead and check out with Alex and James and get into a little market update. Okay, we're all excited to present the last market update for the year. Not a ton of big data coming out over the next couple of weeks, but we finally are getting data after the government shutdown. So we have a couple Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers to talk about that came out last week. The big one, I think, that was months awaited was the unemployment report. So what do you feel like we learned from that after waiting for 3 months to get an official sort of up-to-date unemployment report?
You know, Jim, it was kind of showed us where the vibes and what everyone was kind of expecting out of this employment report to be. It was, a net loss on jobs, about 105,000 lost in October, about 30K added in November, I believe. Overall, it does not show us a strong labor market, which is where everyone's at right now. And more so, you are seeing that, you know, it's a slow to hire, low fire environment. There seems to be quite a lot of stickiness with labor right now. You know, if you are employed, you're going to stick with your employer. You're really not looking around too hard. And that seems to be the theme that's carrying us through the end of the year here. There was definitely some interesting crossover, I think, in regards to the layoffs that we saw in October and ticks up on the unemployment claims that I know James wanted to cover.
Yeah, so I think, you know, you can go head over to the BLS website yourself and check it out if you want to see it. But they give you a pretty good breakdown, a drill down of where was the employment and unemployment, what's been happening over the last 12, 6, or the last month. So, you know, we had been delayed this report for a while, so we didn't really get to see. October finally comes out and bang, 105K jobs lost. It's really kind of a shocking headline. But once people were able to look at it a little bit more, it made more sense. So back in April, you know, when DOGE came in, they started laying off federal employees. One of the offers they gave them was called the fork, right? So the fork was, hey, you could leave right now. We'll pay you for another 6 months, or you could stay around and risk getting chopped, right? So there's a lot of people who took the fork, and they had about 6 months of pay that comes to an end in October. So if you look at the BLS's website and you check out, hey, where were the jobs that we lost? It's almost entirely from the government. It really kind of explains almost the whole number there. And it is just the layoffs, the actual firings that they did, as well as people who were finally done being paid. So now that they were no longer being paid, they counted into the unemployment report. So it is a little bit settling that it was all part of the plan. However, 105,000 losses is, it's not a great plan. Interestingly, private education and health, which, you know, Department of Education has been also getting cut. And then health and human services is definitely a huge conversation across the economy right now. So those are two places that we have absolutely seen grown so far this year, past 12 months.
Yeah, that's a super interesting stat about the government jobs, kind of a little bit under the radar, just basically voluntary layoffs, right, that folks took. So 6 months of benefits, and then now they're getting into the roles and saying that they have to be absorbed somewhere, which is an interesting dynamic we'll have to figure out in 2026, right? But then you've got healthcare kind of pulling all of the weight, like it's been doing for the past 2 years, it feels like. It was healthcare. It was also hospitality, which has slowed down, I think, because people are spending less money, but still seeing just a ton of jobs added in healthcare. Without that number, we would have been deeply negative, probably both of these last two reports, right?
That number is, if you look at the chart, it is the overwhelming number. Even with the government cuts, it is the largest number on there. So without that, it would be a scarier situation for sure.
Right. But still, unemployment report is still at right there around 4.5, 4.6, which is getting into that unacceptable territory for the Fed, despite the migration issue, right? Which if we did not have a major drawdown in migration into this country, we would likely have a much higher unemployment report, because we're not creating any jobs. At the very least, we're not creating jobs. That we're likely going to continue to show that we're losing jobs incrementally going into next year, I would think.
Yeah, two things there, Jim. You know, like you said, if you're going to take away anything from this unemployment report, I think just top line, we saw another 0.1% tick up in the unemployment rate. And like you said, that's entering the scary zone for the Fed. We're now at 4.5%, and between 4.5 and 5 is when they start to think that, you know, the labor market might be, you know, in a very weak position. And then on top of that, as you already alluded to, you know, we've seen mass exodus from this country this year, you know, both forced and voluntary deportations. We don't have an exact number on how many people have, you know, left the United States, but that has definitely helped to keep the unemployment rate suppressed, just because a lot of those individuals would be sitting on the unemployment report as well.
Right. All right. Obviously, we will talk about it a little bit later, just in our preview for 26, but, you know, the jobs reports are going to be the number one, if not the number two thing that we'll be watching next year, barring any sort of major global event, as it relates, when we're worried about interest rates, you know, what should we be watching? But the other one could be CPI, could be inflation, right? CPI came out last week, full report again this time, although there was some question about how reliable some of the data is becoming, right? Remember, all the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers are mostly based on survey information, right? You know, are you working? Do you have a job? Did you lose your job? And then on the inflation side, what are you paying for bacon? What are you paying for fuel? That sort of thing. But nonetheless, the headline number was lower than expected, still closer to 3 than 2. It's at 2.7. But I don't know, what are we learning, do you think, from some of these numbers that seem to be defying gravity this year as it relates to things like tariffs and a fairly stable economy, or even a resilient economy that should maybe be driving prices higher?
Yeah, on the inflation front, this is definitely a number I would not take at the headline value. Folks were pretty quick to point out that this is a pretty major surprise to the downside. Expectations were for 3 to 3.1% from all the major aggregators. To come in at, you know, close to 0.5% under is a pretty big miss. And what people noticed was that rents and owner's equivalent rent were just carried over from September. They didn't have any new readings there. And as you said, Jim, you know, we've been talking about this for months now with the labor constraints at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The more and more that they are just imputing certain numbers from a larger headline number, it's going to lead to some more static in the data. That being said, I would have at least expected them to, you know, applied some sort of calculation to a September number, but you know, it looks like they control copy, control pasted the September numbers in. And these rents account for, you know, most people, that's it's a major living expense for most people. And in their weightings, it's about 25% for the inflation reading. So, you know, carrying these numbers over from September, having a net 0% inflation on 25% of your weight of your total calculation is going to suppress your inflation quite a bit. And so if you look at the bond market didn't blink on this at all. The 10-year is still trading around a three-month high, which is, you know, we started cutting 3 months ago. So we're not seeing the long end of the curve come down.
Mm-hmm. Agreed, for a number of reasons, which we'll get into here just in a couple minutes, because I think it's going to be one of the bigger stories of 2026. All right. Why don't we go talk about that? Let's switch over to our 2026 preview. We're going to talk a little bit today about a few things. We'll get to some holiday fun and cheer here in a minute, but what we really want to get to in terms of content is what to watch out for in 2026. Obviously, a lot to consider when you're thinking about interest rates. We'll try to focus mainly on what's going to affect potentially interest rates as we go into 2026. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen. But there's a lot of things that we should be keeping our eye on in the kind of the macro economy, as well as in our industry. We're going to talk a little bit about the Fed here in a minute, too. Of course, you know, major events can happen, major dislocations like we saw in 2020 or going back to 2007 or even 99. But we're just going to kind of talk about if things stay generally status quo, what does that look like for interest rates? How do these different pieces drive mortgages? And then what else is going on in our industry in terms of possible changes or possible improvements? So let's just start with mortgage rates in general, right? We all like to wax about this, whether you're at a conference, or you're talking to a client, or we're just talking amongst ourselves at the dinner table, right? We find mortgage rate projections fairly interesting. And over the past, you know, 4 years, I feel like it's been really, there's been a lot of variability between different projections. But this last like year and a half, I think the economists have come to terms with the fact that if nothing major changes, rates are just going to kind of stay where they are. So if you look at some of the major entities like the MBA, Wells Fargo, Fannie, Freddie, they all have interest rates sticking around where they are right now for the foreseeable future, like going into the end of not just next year, but the year after that. I think, you know, it's for all the reasons that we've talked about on this podcast that you'll read about in the news. There's just very little reason for rates to drop. There's very little pressure, downward pressure on rates, even with global conflict going on, which you would think would drive rates lower. There's just all this upward pressure, right? Everything from defense spending, which we're still unsure what that looks like. We're still putting a lot of pressure on our NATO allies to increase defense spending, which has yet to happen. So there's going to be a ton of debt, new debt that comes online, not just our own national debt, but across Europe next year. There's all of this spending that you hear about with AI and technology investment. Much of that does not come from cash or stock sales. It comes from generating more debt, issuing more corporate bonds. So who's going to buy that? Like, you know, we likely need yields to remain high to attract capital to actually fund a lot of these projects that are going on. So it's a good thing that we're, you know, as a nation and as a kind of developed world, we're looking to continue expanding, but it takes a ton of debt, world record ever debt to get that done.
Yeah, no, well put, Jim. I think it's, you know, it's a limited number of dollars chasing yield is really the headline story there. You know, this isn't the days of 2020, 2021 when we're awash with 0% federal funds rate cash. You know, we've returned to median in my opinion. And like you said, there's immense capital expenditure going on out there in the private sector right now, much less so the at the national level as well. But I think in the U.S. economy alone, you're seeing some crowding out being done by those capital expenditures from mainly those major technology companies. But it's really everyone is investing pretty heavily right now, and they're funding that with debt. You know, I think with the current administration, there's been an acceptance of, yeah, we do need to reshore certain elements of, you know, national defense, maybe, or maybe not national defense, maybe it's under the guise of national defense, but reshoring of some sort of production and industry. And all these things are very capital intensive. So I agree with the outlooks that Fannie Mae and the MBA have put out. I don't see much downward pressure.
Right. And you've pointed this out before too. An additional component would be that, you know, the equity markets have done very well over the past few years, and the returns there are going to be at least what you would get in bonds, if not better. So there's a lot of capital that's then parked in equities that's not going to make its way back into bonds unless we have some sort of capitulation in those two different asset classes. And that kind of generates itself too. The more money that goes into the stock market, obviously, the better it performs. So we don't have that classic, I don't know, seesaw effect where we start seeing maybe a weakening economy. We're certainly seeing weakening jobs. You would normally see more money come back into bonds and maybe a little bit of a sell-off in equities, but that's not happened. It could in 26, I suppose. We haven't seen it.
Yeah, no, that's a great point as well. I think, you know, a number of factors. It's been a while since there's been a large drawdown, a long sustained drawdown in equities, which, you know, scares people out of the market into something safer, like, you know, your monthly or yearly payment on your bond. And in addition to that, I think it's been made so easy to invest in equities. I think what we forget is how recent it is that just about anyone with a bank account can buy a share of an ETF, which is an instantly diversified portfolio. And so I think that makes it really easy. And when we're averaging north of 10% on the S&P 500 every year, yeah, why would you, you know, get a measly 5% bond, right?
I think that is an excellent point to it, is retail investors are more and more and more the story. You know, since 2020, it's been coming on, and a lot of, you know, the CEOs, the execs at, you know, Robinhood or Acorns or whatever these platforms are that are trying to push more and more people to get into it. You know, now that you're looking at the market, you're looking at actually investing, why would you go with the 5% bond when you get 10 or 11 on the stock market? You almost seem silly. And it's, if you've never lived through a downturn, you wouldn't know the risk that you might be getting into.
Great point. There's definitely some macro effects here that have just like monumental shifts in the investor community. I would even add that, you know, I was talking with some family this weekend about this, where, you know, 30, 40 years ago, pensions were a vast majority of how people retired. But right now, people are dumping money in the stock market because you have to. You have to have a 401k. You don't have that automatic retirement plan from your company that you work for or the business that you're running. You have to invest, and there's almost nowhere else to put your money that gives decent returns that would give you a chance, you know, of retiring, you know, in your 60s. So again, it's a snowball effect. So something to watch for this year. Can the equity market outperform bonds once again? Will we see double-digit S&P gains? This year especially, it depends on who you ask, whether it's Goldman Sachs or Citadel or whoever you want to ask, right? There's very, very different opinions out there. But again, everyone kind of has a little bit of a bias. If I'm an investment bank, I want people to continue investing. So my projections are probably not going to be dire, right?
Yeah, at this point, you know, and with how captured the top indexes are by technology firms, it's really, at the end of the day, it's how long you think the technology current upswing can sustain itself. You know, you've had doomsday sayers from day one, and I think that there's a more emerging or maybe a more reasonable voice when it comes to talking about the capabilities of some of these technology companies. But I you know, the markets can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. So, you know, we could see this, you know, continue on for a long while more.
Very true. There's going to be winners and losers at some point, though. It does feel like the NVIDIAs of the world are, at least for short term, the likely winners. But these things turn always at some point. All right. So speaking of expectations, we got to talk about the Fed, right? The Fed is always on the front page, especially this last couple of years, between the Fed having a huge participation in just money being dumped into the market during the pandemic, and then putting the brakes on at some point when inflation reached almost 10%, and now kind of holding down that pedal, much to the chagrin of business investors and the administration and the White House. But there's going to be a lot of turnover. We know that. The Fed is going to be made up of, the voters are going to be made up of different people by probably first quarter, if not mid-year in 2026. So what should we be watching out for there in terms of the makeup of the Fed, but also where that interest rate path might go?
I think this is definitely going to be a major story early, right? Because it's been a conversation of the Fed's independence and where it's going to go, who's going to be in charge of this. We all know that Powell comes up in May, and he's not done as a voter, but he is done as the chair. And so, you know, 50-50 on who you think the next chair will be there's a lot of back and forth on that. But regardless, there are four other members who are going to turn over this year. So Collins, Goolby, Schmidt, and Musalem will all be done in either February or March of this year. So by Q1, that is four voting members of the Fed will be gone. You know, it's a 12 individual board. Two of them were already picked by the current administration. The chair will be picked by the current administration. And you could put a giant asterisk next to Lisa Cook as to what will happen with her, because she's currently under investigation for mortgage fraud, right? So you know, by the beginning of Q2, you could have almost 8 to 9 members of the Fed would be picked by the administration. The conversation, you know, if you look at a guy like Mirren, he's been saying now 50 basis points, we should do 50 basis points, we can keep going. Some of these members who are going to leave are saying we should stop, right? We should keep it here. Those are the voices who are leaving. Who will be replacing them will probably be more aggressive on rate cuts. So it does paint the picture of we will see more. I think that's why if you check the CME's website, you can still see there's some projection that we'll get rate cuts moving forward, you know, 2 more next year. But with, you know, jobs numbers, as we've talked about, and inflation, that is the tension.
Yeah. I mean, we always say follow the money, but to me, the money seems like it's a little bit light on rate cuts next year, given all the things you just said and what we see in the jobs numbers, right? If we have a pretty quick shift in the makeup of the Fed towards more dovish, and we have a jobs market that continues to stagnate or get even worse, like, yeah, 2 to 3 cuts are what is priced in with futures contracts. That seems low, doesn't it? You feel like we get at least a point, if not a point and a half total by the end of 2026, even if things just kind of continue on the tilt that they're on right now.
You could push the argument that in the long arm of American rates, 5% has been kind of an average or a low. So getting below that to like 3.25 or 3, where those rate cuts would get us, that's pretty low. That's pretty kind of loose with the capital. So it is maybe a return to mean that there's just kind of this, it's very low. What would that do to inflation? Could we really justify it? Will it snap us back, even if these voices are coming and want to cut? Does it make sense?
So we're kind of approaching a natural neutral policy if we have 2 to 3 cuts versus if we were to cut 2 points, like I think Myron would like to see, we might stoke inflation again, or we might be in a more expansionary policy realm where we don't need to be yet.
Yeah. I mean, when you say point and a half to the low, you know, that's the most aggressive voice in the room of Myron. You know, I'm definitely of the opinion that once they have, you know, board capture, if you want to call it that, here starting in Q2 or the second half of next year, that, yeah, I'm of the opinion we're going to see 3, maybe 4 cuts next year. I'm not sure if we'll see as many as Myron wants, but I expect the rate path, at least for the federal funds rate next year, to be what everyone was freaking out about middle of this year. So I think the 2025 rate path people were calling for is just being pushed forward into 26, early part of 27. Keep in mind this year is an election year as well. So politics will play, I think, into some of the rate decisions in the summer.
Right. Yeah. Another thing to watch out for mid-year, end of year is control of the chambers. It is a midterm election year. Great. So yeah, Fed, probably a few cuts. Despite that, projections for mortgage rates are still between 5.9, 6.2. So the expectation there would just be a steeper yield curve, I suppose, which could be then indirectly good for interest rates on mortgages, you would think, because banks start to get a little more profitable. They start to have a little more incentive to buy longer term assets because those rates are higher and they can borrow cheaper from the Fed. But still, the projections from most economists don't see even 3 rate cuts doing a whole lot for our industry in terms of just notional interest rates. What else do we have? Like jobs, that's, again, probably the biggest one. What's the job market going to do next year? That could affect how the Fed operates, could affect stock market, certainly could affect the possibility of a recession, you know, by way of lowering GDP at the same time that tariffs are really starting to take hold and folks are figuring out where to extract additional profit margin, as James pointed out last week, right? We're still not sure who's paying for these tariffs, really, ultimately. Anyway, so, I mean, jobs, we talked a little bit about it earlier just with yesterday or last week's jobs report. But what do the pundits expect as we go into 2026 for jobs?
it's a little hard to see the jobs just I've heard the conversation that, hey, by Q2, it might, this kind of downcline that we're on might slow out and even start to rebound. I'm not sure I see that so rosy. You know, if we get rate cuts, that adds more, you know, liquidity to the market and to people's ability to start new businesses, businesses to take on debt wonderfully and hire more people. But this low hire, low fire environment, I think we're going to be in that for a minute. We're probably going to be kind of camping here. Even if you have more money, is the first thing you're going to do, you know, hire new people when everyone's a little freaked out about the AI bubble maybe coming to a stop? Or, you know, what is going to happen with these tariffs? Is our market going to take another hit? Are we selling enough overseas or even internally? If people have been slowing down consumer spending and consumer outlook is so low, why would you hire more people to produce more? You're kind of taking a risk there.
Right. So uncertainty is still just driving a little bit of conservative approach to growth and thus hiring additional people within your business. That makes a lot of sense. I think we'll see something similar probably in our industry. I mean, I think we will see a little bit of an improvement in volume in the mortgage industry. That's what the MBA is saying. And, you know, based on where interest rates are and the fact that there's still several million mortgages out there that have a interest rate above 6 or 6.5. So I think we'll just continue to see some of that refi turnover if rates don't go up to 7. And we'll get to housing here in a minute, but I think the housing market will be more vibrant, at least more active than it's been in a couple of years in 2026 also. But why don't we talk about that? Let's talk about housing. I think we don't talk a ton about it here because it's not exactly our full expertise, although we're very close to it, you know, living in the mortgage industry. So we follow a lot of the you know, drama around the FHFA, certainly that directly affects housing prices in general that affect things like loan limits. We're all following, you know, Bill Pulte's activity recently. In fact, there was an article written last week just in the way of, I don't know, things to watch out for. It was the earnings call for, I believe it was Lennar, one of the big housing builders, where they've been called in. Some of the home builders have been called in to meet with Pulte and potentially the president and others to talk about, again, what can we do about affordability in 2026? So interested to see what comes out of that. Obviously, we should be cautious. We had the discussions a couple of months ago where Pulte had pulled in mortgage experts like Barry Habib and some others to talk about what could be done about LLPAs or G fees and other things in the, you know, the GSE space to make housing more affordable. But now they're talking to the builders. I think, you know, during the campaigns, there was talk from both candidates about what could be done potentially about housing. I don't know that the Trump administration relied heavily on that part of their campaign promises, but they did say that they would do everything possible to bring the right people in a room to talk it through. So again, cautiously optimistic that we get some creativity there from the home builders, even if it's something that doesn't just affect new homes, but hopefully affects existing sales as well.
Absolutely. I think we're all well aware that the long-term way we get out of the issues that we see in the housing market is to build more. At the end of the day, there are simply not enough homes for the number of people in this country that would like to own a home, which I think is just about everybody. And bringing in the home builders is absolutely a good idea. I think, though, it was said on one of our first casts with the BOK guys, they were talking about how at the end of the day, you know, you can subsidize at the national level. You can, you know, put together economic plans that favor the home builders. But in a lot of cases, it turns out to be a pretty local issue on home building. And there's a lot of regulation and red tape at the local level or the state level that would also need to be cut. So I'm cautiously optimistic there. I do hope that they come out with something, you know, if there is some sort of subsidy that they're going to do or anything to push home builders to build more would be great. Make it affordable to build those entry-level homes, which are historically the least profitable items for them to build, but is also the most in demand unit for those of us that are on the younger end of the age spectrum. So yeah, I hope they do more there. And I've also heard some inklings, just to change the conversation just a little bit. I heard some rumors last week that Bowman, who's on the federal board, Michelle Bowman, she was meeting with some regional bank heads and just talking about liquidity ratios and capital requirements and everything. So they could be you know, pushing on a couple different fronts to try and stoke the mortgage industry here, you know, both on the supply side of the physical asset and maybe to lower rates a little bit with some capital requirement changes.
Yeah, good call there. I'd read that as well. And, you know, as is the case with most Republican administrations, they're looking to deregulate a bit. And most banks, I think, would tell you that they feel like the regulations over the past decade plus, at least since the Great Financial Crisis, have leaned to the restrictive side, have probably made business quite a bit more difficult to get done, with maybe not reducing the risk as much as we would have hoped. So yeah, that could be another story that unfolds in 2026, would be deregulation of banks and capital requirements and servicers as well. There's always a tangent there. I mean, in general, I said it on the last podcast, and I think I know I still think this way. I think if we make some headway with new home sales and we continue to see certain MSAs actually decline in terms of home values, I could see 2026 being a year where we actually have a correction in home prices, because not that we will be able to build so many houses that there are too many, but that this lock-in effect, right, of existing homes where folks have been sitting on their mortgage for the last 3, 4, 5 years are finally seeing prices start to decline, and putting that into their math, right, to say, I know if I move, I'm going to have to pay a higher rate, but if my home loses 5% this year, 5% next year, and so on, I'm going to be in a worse financial position, and I've been kind of waiting for the top, and maybe I saw the top in 2025. And then if that snowballs, right, where you have that lock-in effect break apart for a lot of different MSAs, we could actually see a major increase in home sales volume, which to me could lead to a correction in the short term, like not a 2007 correction, but just if just a bunch of liquidity of homes is dumped onto the market, you could see it really being a buyer's market at that point. You know, you still have all these young people, right? The average home buyer age is higher than it's ever been. That starts, you know, those younger people start to finally jump in and say, okay, the house I've been looking at or the neighborhood has dropped, you know, 10%. I'm going to jump in now. Like, that makes my payment something that I can handle. Anyway, and that could snowball to where we see that correction, because otherwise, what are we looking at? Rates almost certainly aren't going to plummet. Wages are not going to double in 2026, most likely. So the only other lever is cheaper houses.
A little bit of a counter idea too that I heard. I was listening on a town hall earlier this week, and just the conversation about people who are sitting on these lower rates who have been here for a long time. One of the major themes we might be looking at in 2026 is HELOCs, right? A home equity line of credit. Someone who's been sitting there, if your house is not really appreciating anymore and you can't afford to upgrade, what you're going to do is you're going to upgrade your house yourself, right? So you're going to take out that line of credit. And so you're going to try and make the house worth a little bit more. You're going to use the money in that way to push it up and to stay in that lower rate, right? So that's kind of a theme that I thought was an intelligent thought that looking at 2026, we might be seeing more of.
Yeah, good call. I think you see that in economies like we're seeing today. If you can't upgrade by moving, you upgrade by staying and, you know, popping the top, if you will, or adding an addition or finishing your basement into a couple of bedrooms to allow for a growing family, or just your income, your job situation has improved over the last few years and you want something a little nicer, but you don't want to double your mortgage just by way of the interest burden.
The nice thing about both these stories is for our industry and those of us in the mortgage profession, it both produces a couple more mortgages out
volume.
There.
Volume.
Volume.
All about volume. All right. So we talked about a couple things, other just kind of industry related items with the FHFA potentially getting creative again this year by way of doing something through the GSEs. Could happen, might not happen. I feel like a lot of the ideas that were kicked around earlier this year would lead to lower profitability of the GSEs, which, do we want to see that? Or is that something we're trying to maintain? You can't have both, I don't think. Have a wildly profitable GSE and somehow drop rates 0.5%. So we'll see how that, if anything more pans out there. The privatization of the GSEs is definitely something to keep an eye on, but we've been talking about it since November, I would say, since the election, pretty heavily, and it's not happened yet. It still could. I don't know. finger in the air, minor disruption to the industry. If that happens, it's unlikely that would lead to instantly lower rates, but could be, I don't know, could lead to maybe more efficient management, different type of process, more seeking profit rather than relying on some of the missions and goals of the FHFA. I don't know. Anything else you all would think we'd want to keep an eye on in terms of the GSEs next year?
I agree with you. I think out of the gates, it'd be more headlines than tangible benefits or, you know, downsides on the long term. Depending on how they behave out in the private markets, we could definitely see improvements in rates so long as, you know, they keep themselves afloat and we don't see a repeat of history.
Right. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, look for more drama around the credit score agencies. You know, you've got Vantage, which is relatively new. You got FICO coming out with their FICO 10T. Like those are there. They've not yet been fully adopted by the ultimate buyers, you know, the investors or even fully by the GSEs, meaning they haven't been built into their pricing structures yet, but probably some noise around that this year. Hopefully good noise and a little bit more efficiency. Obviously watch the FHFA recapture. Recapture will continue to be a big topic this year. Again, you know, there are millions of mortgages literally that are over 6% still that were originated over the past few years. So there's still opportunity there for refis. Obviously, like we talked about with the housing market, opportunity for purchases. What else did we miss today? I mean, you never know what could happen. I mean, you still have global tensions. I mean, we are flirting with a conflict with Venezuela right now. Typically, global conflict, especially if we're directly involved, leads towards lower rates. I mean, the rates we're seeing right now, to me, go all the way back to the very short Iran conflict we had along with Israel over the summer, right? Rates have not recovered from that. So maybe that's a good thing. At the same time, you have the Fed starting to dabble more in buying treasuries, which is going to keep rates a little bit lower.
What, like what else is going to happen in the world? We also have, they're going to vote on healthcare in January.
Right. So that's coming up here in a few weeks.
Yeah. So in January, the Congress still needs to vote on what to do with healthcare, the Obamacare subsidies. It's definitely in this story about inflation and affordability, doubling in some places, you know, more costs that you're going to be paying every single month, kicking like a million or more Americans off of health insurance. It's going to be a major story, especially again, leading into an election year. I think that they're going to have to figure something out to save face and to make sure that, you know, power can be maintained.
Right. Big vote coming up. Hopefully does not lead to another shutdown in the first quarter. So that's not free to do, right? That's not inexpensive to the economy or to the general morale of the nation.
Not at all, but
economic,
I think,
data.
Yes. That as well. It gives us nothing to talk about on this podcast almost, other than the shutdown.
Yep. I think a bright spot there is we have a good path forward there in that four Republicans defected from the majority there to secure this vote on healthcare. So I think it seems to be kind of crossing party lines, and maybe the Republican hold on the Senate is a little bit more tenuous than it was during the shutdown.
I think I agree with that take very much.
Okay, so maybe the first thing to watch out for is this vote, which will come in about mid-January when everybody comes back from their respective holiday breaks in the House and the Senate. All right, maybe we wrap it up with a little holiday cheer then. Speaking of the holidays, thank you, James, for having the tree in the background this week. That's incredible. I love the hat there. That's just been fun to have on here in case anybody was wondering whether or not this was recorded right around the holidays. There's your answer. Let's go maybe around the room. What's your like holiday activity? What did you do last week, or what are you going to do this week, or towards the end of the year? Like, what's your favorite thing to do around the holidays with friends or family? Why don't we start with you, James? Other than putting up a Christmas tree in your podcast studio, what are we doing for the holidays?
You know, I live real close to my family, which is nice and convenient for the holidays. So we always get together for it, and we tend to get a puzzle and we put it together, and it's kind of, you know, over the course of December and January, you know, whenever you're at the house, you throw it together. So by the end of the year, we should have finished it out. So that's always a nice tradition.
Nice. You're talking like a big, like 1,000-piece jigsaw type?
Yeah, more like the old folks' homes kind of one. It's really supposed to keep going for months, but we tend to put it together pretty quick.
Nice. Good brain exercise. Good way to kind of gather people around a coffee table.
Exactly.
Or the dining room. Nice. How about you, Alex?
For me, it's just the general vibe around the holidays. It's just sitting around, a little bit less work, take a few days off work, string together a couple nice four-day weekends into the new year, and eat to my heart's content. So, yeah, just relaxing through the end of the year.
Nice. Very good. Yeah, I guess mine's somewhere in the middle. It's, you know, obviously kind of a nutty time of year, especially with a growing family. So you've got, you're hosting this or you're driving to that. One of the things we do, just the four of us, you know, Jenny and the girls, is we go see the Nutcracker every year right before Christmas. So we're going to do that tomorrow night. So that's just a fun tradition we've had forever. Actually, Jenny used to go with her grandmother way back in the day before we ever met, but when she was a little girl. So it's fun to bring our daughters to that show and have a nice dinner and just kind of disappear for a couple hours in the, if you've ever been, it's kind of a magical thing, right? The Nutcracker. It's not, I've never much been into ballet in general, but just kind of a cool holiday tradition, fun thing to do. All right. What do you, last thing, what are you hoping to get for Christmas this year, James? What do you want? Or Hanukkah or whatever holiday, like, what do you hope to get as a gift this holiday season?
I'm looking for a few more rate cuts. That's what I'd like for Christmas this year. I think I've been looking for a new background, so it might take me a little bit longer than Christmas, but we might be changing this up behind me, which will be nice.
All right. Yeah. As long as, the tree's a great touch, but if you replace that with something, once we get into the first quarter, maybe it's something that's a little also wintry, and then you get into spring, something that could be cool. Could be a running deal.
Keep the tree around until July. See if I can't turn it brown. That would be
How about you, Alex?
It's very utilitarian, and I actually already got it from the girlfriend for Black Friday, it was on sale, but just a good pair of all-weather boots needed that moving out east, so.
That's right. You're walking through New York City in the winter. It hasn't snowed a lot yet, but it will. You'll get that. You don't want absorbent footwear in that kind of environment. I'll stay on the footwear vibe, I guess. I've always wanted a pair of Jordans. Never had one when I was a kid. And we did a Secret Santa exchange with Jenny's side of the family this weekend. And my brother-in-law got me a pair of Jordans, my first pair ever. So I'll be wearing those maybe into the office tomorrow. Everybody can check them out. I can kind of strut down.
I knew I was coming back
17th.
To Denver at a good time.
That's right.
You guys going to hit the court together?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be... be hooping it up out in the parking lot outside Dominion Towers tomorrow if anybody wants to join us.
Next week, I'll be wanting a new ACL for Christmas.
Yeah. My Achilles hurts just thinking about it. Well, right on. Good way to end it. This is our last podcast of the year. Thank you, gentlemen, for an awesome discussion. We gave folks a lot to think about, I think, and all of it may be proven wrong. But for now, these are our things to watch and some of our unvarnished opinions on these subjects. So thanks for listening this year, and we'll see you again in 2026.
Happy holidays, everyone.
Happy holidays. And that is it for today. Another great episode. Alex, James, thanks so much for the conversation. This will be our last podcast of the year, so we won't have one next week, but tune in on January 5th. Where we'll have a brand new episode to kick off the year. Make sure you register for our summit. That's coming up here in February. You can't miss out on that. And just a big thank you. I want to say thank you to everybody, to all of our listeners, people who have followed us this year, to our podcast team, to Matt and the rest of the crew that produced this podcast, and of course to everybody within OB that's on the podcast. Big thanks to all of our guests. We've had some really spectacular guests this year, and thanks to our team at OB, just the desks that we work on, the trade desk, as well as just all of OB, who just makes this a super special place to work. And happy holidays, everybody. Again, reach out to us. We mentioned this last week at podcast@optimalblue.com. As we're wrapping up this amazing year, we want to hear from you. What do you want to hear about in 2026? on this podcast. So we've created this Optimal Insights listener inbox at podcast@optimalblue.com. Obviously, we can't respond to everybody's comments and requests, but we'll certainly keep them all in mind. We want to know what you like, what you don't like about the podcast. So thanks again. And that's it for today. Join us in 2 weeks for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we will continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.
Speed matters in lending, and borrowers expect instant answers. But traditional loan locking ties you to a desk, slowing decisions and creating friction. That's why Optimal Blue introduced mobile locking in our mobile app. Now, loan officers can lock loans anytime, anywhere, fast, secure, and accurate. Access your live pipeline, update loan details, run pricing, and complete locks right from your phone. No delays, no desk dependency. Just instant action that enhances the borrower experience. Unlike browser-based tools, mobile locking is built into our native iOS and Android app for faster load times, stronger security, and a seamless experience. And the best part? It's included at no extra cost for all Optimal Blue PPE users. Download the Optimal Blue mobile app today and start locking loans on the go. Access, price, lock, it's that simple.